Life Incorporated.
We've been building our world to the needs of financial markets rather than creating financial markets that serve the needs of people and our world.
That's Doug Rushkoff. We talked to him about what happens when every aspect of our lives is ruled by corporations.
These three sex scandals turned attention toward first the Sea Street House, but then the family and the much larger story of the group behind the Sea Street House.
And that's Jeff Charlotte. He'll tell us about how the sex scandals in Washington are cracking the facade of unity on the Christian right. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In his book, Capital, Karl Marx posed the idea that capitalism leads to a peculiar distortion of relationships in society. He called it the fetishism of commodities. He said that although the market and the way things are produced for it are social constructions, that is, relationships between people, this social relationship assumes the, quote, fantastic form of a relation between things. And that means that capitalism appears to be natural and eternal, rather than just one way among many that people have created and organized an economy. My guest Doug Rushkoff says corporate control of our society has reached into all arenas of human relations, so much so that we are increasingly disconnected from each other and locked out of expressing our true creativity and humanity. The free market is a fiction, and so, fundamentally, is democracy. Rushkoff's new book is Life Incorporated, How the World Became a Corporation, and How to Take It Back. I was joined on this interview by guest co-host Bill Bowie. He and I produce another radio show about business and sustainability called Sea Change Radio. Doug Rushkoff, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Your book, Life Incorporated, starts out in a neighborhood I'm well familiar with because I actually lived there when I was a little kid, before it became gentrified, and that's Park Slope.
Right.
Tell us what happened to you and, as a result, your epiphany.
Well, I was living in an apartment I could barely afford in Park Slope. I was a renter amongst mostly owners, and hoping to step up to the plate and man up, as my friend said, and, you know, borrow $1 million in order to buy a house. And I was taking out the garbage in front of my apartment, and I got mugged. I got mugged at gunpoint by, you know, some guy. It's interesting, when I was actually mugged, I asked him to give me my health insurance card back, figuring, you know, if he saw it as me and him against the man, you know, the big HMO, that he might not kill me. But when I got back up to the apartment, I posted on this email list called the Park Slope Parents List, which is a, you know, nice, lefty, crunchy, caring, you know, list of parents usually are, you know, emailing each other about breastfeeding strategies or, you know, which private school is the most left-leaning. And I posted the, you know, time and location where I got mugged, figuring people would want to know that this had happened in the neighborhood and we could talk about, you know, how do we make it safer? How do we find this guy? You know, what do we do? And the first two emails I received in response to my posting were from people who were angry that I had posted the location of my mugging because this could negatively affect their property values. And it was kind of a shock, you know, that people cared more about the short-term asset value of their homes as property than the long-term experiential value of their homes as places that they actually lived. And it really turned my inquiry from kind of a historical inquiry and a kind of a deconstruction of money and corporations and how does this all work, to more a look at, you know, what is the process by which we internalize the values of corporations to the point where we as human beings behave more like corporations than like people?
This is a very visceral thing. I mean, there was a fascinating thing that the police detective said when you went to report this crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was weird. I mean, I had hung out with them for a while, looking at mugshots and stuff, and talking about what happened to me on the internet, and how, you know, the Park Slope residents seemed more concerned with insulating themselves from, if you will, the indigenous populations of their gentrified neighborhoods than engaging with them. And the cops actually, they took me to this map of Brooklyn, and they drew a circle around Park Slope. And, you know, they said, you know, this is the target area. You know, and they had a very straightforward view of what was going on, that, you know, rich people came in and kind of took over from this target area and expanded this circle outward, and that if you live inside the circle, then you are the mugging candidate. And if you live outside the circle, then you are, you know, the displaced, you know, residents of 1970s or 80s Park Slope.
It's almost as if they are outside the corporatized economy, and so they're no longer of value or worth.
Well, in a way, I mean, in a way, they're still a part of it. I guess, you know, to the corporatized economy, these people are looked at more as, well, the people you just keep somewhere. You just want to keep them quiet. You know, how much do we have to pay to keep them out of the system, in a way? Well, you know, at least they're not going to compete with our companies. They're not going to create value. In a certain way, it's almost as if the system would prefer to have this population just out of commission, even if it's costing something, to keep them that way, than competing for jobs and places and everything else.
And you also talk about this kind of progressive abstraction of reality that occurs as a result of the corporation. You know, maybe this would be a good point to kind of give us a Cliff Notes version of some of the history of how this came about, this abstraction away from reality, whereby reality is really mediated by our relationships to the central corporation.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Most of us, you know, we're born into this world, and we look at these rules as given circumstances. And I'm sure a lot of people who've listened even to the conversation so far are saying, well, that's just the way the world works. You know, if you got more money, you move into a neighborhood. And you can, you know, if the market value goes up, then the people who are living there can't afford it anymore and they got to go somewhere else. That's the tough logic of real life. And, you know, it's not actually just the tough logic of real life. It's the result of a set of rules that were put in place, you know, a long time ago for reasons that have nothing to do with today's economy, and by people who have, you know, long since left the building. And I trace it back really to the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, where, you know, most simply, the middle classes and the merchant classes, real people, were starting to get rich, and feudal lords and these sort of early proto-kings were getting poor relative to this rising middle class, and they needed to rejigger the system so that people who had been rich for the last four or five centuries without working would find a new way to basically stay rich by being rich. And they came up with two main things. They came up really with lending money and investing money. You know, either, you know, they created central banks and centralized currency so that instead of people earning currency into existence locally, they would have to borrow money from the central treasury in order to do business. And they created large corporations, which were actually monopolies, which gave the rich people a chance to invest in business rather than creating value. So everything started to happen in long-distance ways and at arm's length. People weren't allowed to trade with one another. You weren't allowed to grow cotton and fabricate it into fabric and then turn it into mittens. There was a specific corporation to whom you'd have to sell your cotton, and another corporation that would fabricate it, and another corporation that would turn it into hats or mittens. So what happened was you weren't really allowed to be in business anymore. The only ones who were allowed to be in business were these giant chartered corporations. So the landscape of commerce changed from lots of different people doing different things and trading and selling and interacting with one another, and it changed really to the sort of the beginning of outsourcing, where now everyone works for a corporation. Everyone saves by giving their money to a corporation. Everyone invests, you know, by giving their money to some other outsourced giant company. And everyone borrows by getting money from some big central institution. And that pretty much is what was handed down to us today. You know, and that's sort of, we look at the world as this, you know, series of abstract entities, you know, with whom we're going to transact.
And they become more real than what we are interaction with the world. I mean, you put me in mind, for example, of the farmers who grow crop but can't save the seeds because those seeds are patented. Or in Bolivia, where Bechtel Corporation got the city contract to build a water system, I'm not sure which city it was, and the residents all of a sudden were forbidden to gather rainwater off their roofs because it would have competed with Bechtel's ownership of the water supplies.
Right. Well, all you have to do is, under the guise of the free market, you legislate so that people aren't allowed to compete with the biggest companies. I mean, so we justify, you know, this corporatization of our world with the logic of the free market when we're not living in a free market at all. We're living on a landscape tilted towards the needs of the very biggest businesses. It's very hard to be a small business person and compete. It's very hard for a small pharmacy to compete against the Walmart. You know, why does Walmart get its stuff cheaper than you or I can? Why does it get its money cheaper than you or I can? And then when we try to regulate any of this, we regulate it from the top down in the biggest way possible. So kids get, you know, poisoned by outsourced toy manufacturing. And what do? We create regulations where now any company that wants to distribute a toy to a kid has to go through, you know, $50,000 or $100,000 of testing on that toy. Well, that's fine for Mattel, but what does that do to every single small toy manufacturer in America? Puts them out of business. So here we have corporate conglomerates outsourcing their toy manufacturing to places in China, making a huge mistake, and then regulation that comes in that actually just gives them even more leverage over any of their would-be competitors.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with author Doug Rushkoff about his book, Life Incorporated. Okay, so you've told us how the corporation came about to begin with. This was something that originated really in the Renaissance and gathered steam. In this country, there was a bit of a different history. Corporations were actually supposed to give back to the commons, to the community.
Well, we had a revolution against corporations. I mean, that's really what the American Revolution was. It had much less to do with some king that nobody really knew than the British East India Trading Company, which was making life miserable. No one was allowed to work for themselves. They all had to work for the company. Working for yourself was an illegal revolutionary act, creating value, doing what we think of as basic commerce. So yeah, we had a revolution, and then after that revolution, we initially decided, well, you know, we shouldn't have corporations at all here, because really what they are chartered monopolies, and they prevent all the kinds of great free market things that we as Americans believe in, all the stuff, you know, that Adam Smith writes about, you know, that The Economist and other, you know, kind of right-wing corporate advocates use now as justifications for what they do, but really isn't about that at all. It's about a scaled economy. So then they argued about it a while, and they decided, well, it's okay, we'll have corporations, but corporations have to be there to serve a purpose other than making money. So it's a great idea. So in other words, it's got to be building a bridge or making a school or doing something that has some social value. Otherwise, there's no real purpose for the government to grant a monopoly to a company, because we don't have kings anymore, so we don't need that king to get rich. So they have to pay back. It has to be paying back society in some way.
Doug, there are a couple of different streams of activity that are moving towards the idea of returning to that original concept of, you know, chartering corporations for the common good. Stakeholders Capital, a local socially responsible investing firm, is promoting common good investing. And Francesca and I just returned from the Summit on the Future of the Corporation, where other initiatives to recharter, to put social and environmental and, you know, economic justice into the charter or the mission of companies. What's your take on these efforts and like efforts to sort of return to the roots of the notion of a company as actually fulfilling some useful function?
I think it's better than nothing, as long as we don't let it convince us that corporations are really the best tool for every job. You know, I would rather have corporations working on with a fundamentally different genetic structure than they have now. I mean, it's going to be a tough turnaround because the entire premise of the corporation was really based on how do we extract value from people and territories. But even if we're able to do that and say, okay, you know, that we're going to try to get a majority of states to really want to set up corporations this way instead of that way, you know, there's still going to be other states that are part of the race to the bottom and say, well, don't worry about it. You can still come down here to Delaware, and we'll let you set up a company that does anything you want. So then we've still got to go to the Supreme Court and the feds and Congress and try to undo the rules that allow corporations to, you know, to be able to trump states' rights if they're doing, you know, trans-state commerce. There's a whole lot to do where, to me, it seems the simpler choice right now is just for people to become involved in extra corporate activity, to learn to engage with one another outside of, you know, in the spiritual sense, you know, outside of branding, to be able to work for and with one another without corporate involvement, to be able to transact, you know, without using you know, Federal Reserve issued centralized currency. That there's a whole swath of human activity that now falls under the rubric of corporate activity that really doesn't need to. So, I mean, that's why I write, and that's why I'm out talking, is to try to help people understand that the world we're living in the world we're living, it looks necessary. Like people say to me, "What, you're going to take away my car? How am I going to get to work?" And it's like, well, yeah, but you've got to understand that the reason why you have to drive to work is because the auto industry helped rebuild our suburbs so that it would require you to use a car to go to work. It's not a pre-existing condition.
And in fact, that is a fascinating history. I mean, it has been told. You know, the story of how GM and other corporations kind of retired the small rail system that used to tie together towns and villages and cities around the nation has been told, but I think you have a very interesting spin on it, and I also think that a lot of people don't realize that whole idea about GM, that what's good for GM is good for the country, came out of that. So run us over that history a little bit and tell us, why were the suburbs built?
Most simply, people have to understand that we are rebuilding our world and have been for a century. We've been building our world to the needs of financial markets rather than creating financial markets that serve the needs of people and our world. So the world we live in has been designed to conform to the logic of the market. And since the Renaissance, the logic of the market has been the growth requirement, that markets need to expand, that a sustainable economy does not work, and it won't. If you are issuing money at interest, then more money needs to be paid back than was issued in the first place. The only way more money is going to be paid back is if more money has been borrowed, and yet more money has been borrowed. And the only way to do that is to have an economy that is expanding, sell more goods to more people in less time, keep production up, grow, 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 right? So the fact that we have to grow and that we've had to grow for so long has gotten us, even the most well-meaning folks, like even, say, FDR, to try to build a nation around the presumption of growth. So he met with the Levitt brothers in the design of Levittown, which was not only created to try to give, you know, houses to returning soldiers so they wouldn't riot and be upset and crazy after World War II, but to try to maximize consumption. So we're going to make small houses that aren't big enough for grandma, that are going to keep each little house for each little nuclear family, that's going to discourage community and sharing and encourage every single family buying one of everything. You know, That's why we got Levittown. And or we're going to build suburbs that promote the sale of automobiles, because we are selling more stuff if every family needs a car or two to get where they need to, rather than just a quarter or 50 cents to get on a rail. You know, rails do not serve the economy by this definition. If the economy needs to grow, then everybody getting to work on trains doesn't help. What helps is building a suburb so that everybody's going to need to buy a car, which is going to also have planned obsolescence, and then buy another car, and so on and so on. So when you start to see that even the very best-meaning people who just wanted to have a way to infinitely expand and grow the U.S. economy were developing a world that would support this view of economics, that would support these markets that were developed by people who've long since left the building, then you start to see that, oh, I get it. This isn't just the way the world is. This is a world that was built around the needs of a particular market model.
And we're at a time when GM came out of bankruptcy on the taxpayer's dime, and jobs are still being shed right and left. So what's good for GM may not really be good for the country. A guy named Charles Wilson was the one who said what's good for GM is good for the country. Tell us about him.
The head of GM, Charles Wilson, became Secretary of Defense. I mean, and the reason he did was because the Defense Department was in charge of the roads, because the justification for spending all this money to build roads to sell GM cars was actually that roads would be needed to move around military people if we got invaded. So what you ended up with, though, was a guy who moved, you know, seamlessly and effortlessly from the halls of corporate power to the halls of government power in order to enact a corporate agenda through the state. And when he was challenged on that by his Senate hearing, he said, well, what's good for General Motors is good for the USA. I thought they were the same thing. And, I mean, in one sense, he's right. I mean, today, they certainly are the same thing. You know, we own GM, but, you know, we own all these corporations, you know, whether it's directly through our tax money or indirectly through our 401k plans. You know, this is not someone else. This is us. This is our country. These are our companies. And we are suffering not from a diminishment of power, but a paucity of imagination and knowledge about how the world works.
And we're talking with Doug Rushkoff about his book, Life Incorporated. It's about how the form of the corporation, after all something created by humans, has colonized every nook and cranny of our lives, as if that's the natural state of things. He says it's not. This book, in it you also talk about how we got into this mortgage crisis, and it's very tied up with this, the whole idea of sprawl, of building suburbs. A lot of people think it happened because, you know, people got greedy and they thought that they could buy more house than they could afford. But you say that it was really pushed by a surplus of money.
Yeah, it's funny that a lot of people I've been engaging with lately argue that it's because, Clinton and others wanted black people to be able to have houses, so that they lowered mortgage standards for black people to, you know, they created specific programs for black people to be able to get mortgages and buy houses, and that these are the folks that then went belly up. It's actually not true. The rate of non-payment for black Americans, African Americans, who bought homes under these special mortgage programs is lower than the average rate of mortgage foreclosure and non-payment. So first off, that fact's not even true. What happened was, it's threefold really, but banks had extra money. You know, they had, investors had more cash than we had asset classes in which to invest that cash. You know, part of that is because of the dot-com boom and the bust. There was all this other cash lying around, and partly because banks need to grow. They have balance sheets, too. They're just corporations themselves. They need to grow, and they need to grow faster. That's what's meant by a derivative. you know, that you have to grow, and the rate at which you grow has to accelerate, and the rate at which you accelerate has to accelerate. So there's all this money looking for customers. What banks sell is debt. That's their product, is debt. They lend money, so they need borrowers. The real estate bubble was really created by a surplus of debt. We had too much debt to sell. Our banks had too much debt, so they created more and more products, what we called innovative financial instruments, to help people borrow more and more money. That's how our real estate market ended up going up, not because more people wanted houses or because they valued the real estate more. It's because money was effectively cheaper because debt was in such surplus. So people borrowed and borrowed and borrowed. I was told by really important, smart, wealthy friends who should know better that I should put, you know, 10% down and borrow $1 million to buy an apartment in Brooklyn. That to not do it is stupid, you know, that to not do it is not manning up. So there were plenty of responsible or responsible-looking mortgage brokers and bankers willing to give me money and to tell me this is how to grow up, son, is to take this product, you know, which is interest-free for 5 years, and then don't worry about what happens after that because your property value will keep going up.
And why didn't you do that?
Because, partly because I was lucky enough to have kind of gone to college during the shift from the Carter years to the Reagan years. You know, I was part of that early post-boomer generation that saw through the ideologies we were being sold. You know, I was kind of too old to become yuppie scum, and just I had too many scruples to do that. So I had always grown up with this real fear, almost a pathological fear of selling out, or of selling out without knowing it, of becoming, you know, in service to the man rather than in service to something else or some, you know, higher minded artistic ideal. So I never saw myself as ever being capable of having a house and a mortgage and all that. I figured I'd always be, you know, poor or on the underclass side of things. And
it saved your butt.
And it did save my butt, because now I'd be in serious trouble. I mean, it was funny. You know, New York Times they killed the piece. I'm not exactly sure why, but New York Times was interviewing me about the book, and this woman was asking why I, you know, decided not to live in Brooklyn and moved to the suburbs. And I said, well, really? Because I couldn't afford Brooklyn. I couldn't afford that place. And she said, well, wait a minute. They told me you were a successful writer. That was really interesting, the idea that success would mean that I've got to have millions of dollars. And I said, to me, being a successful writer means being able to sustain myself and my family by writing. That is success. There's this notion in America that you're not successful if you actually do something for a living, that the object of the game is to get to the place where you don't have to do anything for anyone, where you can literally sell your business. You go public, you get an investor, and then you do nothing. And that's just such an unhealthy and bizarre and disconnected approach to the world. You know, creating value is not a bad thing. It's a fun thing. It's what you do. We don't even need to, you know, put up commie signs of people working with hammers and things. It's fun to do stuff. You know, and we just happen to live in a country where almost nobody does anything anymore. You know, it's not just that we, you know, outsourced or offshored our manufacturing base. It's that we diminished our productive capacity. We've robbed ourselves of expertise. We have no competence in anything. We don't know how to do anything anymore. And we said, oh, okay, we're going to get rid of all these real competencies and develop derivative competencies instead, like we're going to have innovative financial products.
Doug Rushkoff. We'll talk more with him about his book, Life Incorporated, after the break. Stay tuned. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Bill Bowie. We're talking with Doug Rushkoff. Before the break, he was talking about how corporate control of the world, defined both broadly and deeply, is strangling our ability to produce, be creative, and even competent.
Doug, the example that you just described really illustrates one of your key points, that we collectively have largely internalized this corporatization of our language, of our self-concept. What is your sense of the remedy for this? How do we uncorporatize ourselves and take responsibility and accountability for living a life that is not merely an expression of corporateness?
It's really by feeling free to create value for people and to accept value from people. You know, the people who are living in places like Lansing, Michigan right now, where there's not a job to be had and not a corporation willing to step in some sense they're the luckiest right now, because they are forced to concede to the opportunity that the crisis offers us, which is to actually do stuff. If you've got a city filled with people who have no money, who have no jobs, but they have needs and they have skills, then you have the basis of a real economy. So they can start actually doing things for one another. I mean, it's easiest to do it as just a gift economy. What do you need? You need your refrigerator fixed. Cool. What do I need? I need someone to babysit for my kids, or I need someone to walk my grandmother around the block, or do you know how to cook? Does anyone have food? Who knows how to farm? I mean, these are very basic things that most people knew how to do. I mean, our grandparents all knew how to garden. They all knew where carrots came from the ground. I mean, this is not rocket science. Basic human survival in communities is actually a pretty easy thing. I mean, you look at the beginning of the Israeli kibbutz movement, they just threw some seeds in the ground, and they made places to live. So it's not actually that hard. And I'm not saying we all have to return to communes or anything like that, but we can reclaim some of the very basic economic activity that is actually better accomplished on a local level or on a human scale than on a corporate level or a corporate scale. That's things like, food, water, a lot of energy, education. There's things we can provide for one another in a real way. If you're not in such a crisis of need as those in failed GM towns, you can still begin to, I mean, the hardest thing, I think, is for people to accept favors from other people. You know, in Park Slope, I remember, when anyone had a kid, they would then hire a lactation consultant to teach the mother how to breastfeed the child, even though there are plenty of old ladies in the neighborhood who would be more than just down the hall in your building, who are more than happy to come in and say, here's how you do it, kiddo. Why can't we accept that? Is it really because she's not a certified lactation consultant? Is it because we can't, get it reimbursed on our insurance if she's not special? Well, she's not even asking for money. No, it's because we don't want to invite this stranger into our lives. We don't want to accept a gift from someone else, lest we are now indebted to them. We would rather be indebted to Citibank for cash, because that's some clean corporate outsourced transaction, than be indebted to your neighbor for real. But being indebted to your neighbor for real is human connection. That shouldn't be thought of as a bad feeling. That should be thought of as a good feeling. And so it's really a matter of retraining ourselves to see human relationships as sources of joy, meaning, and satisfaction, rather than kind of moments of obligation and confusion.
Well, Doug Rushkoff, as you speak, and you're really talking about us reclaiming our humanness from these artificial constructs, which we call corporations, I think of the growth of, ironically, on the internet, of people, many, many people doing free things. Do you see the virtual world as a place where we have been able to carve out territory in addition to the corporations? I mean, corporations are still there.
To some extent, yeah. I mean, the internet started with public funding. It was such a gift economy where everybody was writing programs for free and sharing things and spending time that, you know, when AT&T was offered the internet, they turned it down. They couldn't see a commercial purpose for it. And that's because, as a proper corporate, you know, corporate capitalist, they look at human activity, and if this is human activity that's not producing and consuming anything, then it's not contributing to the bottom line. And so the internet was allowed to develop as a social medium, really, before it became a commercial medium. And most efforts to turn it into a truly commercial medium have failed. I mean, there are a few websites, you know, Amazon maybe, you know, or eBay, that have successful business models. But for the most part, the internet's been a huge business failure. And that's a good thing, you know, because not that it failed business, but that it keeps refusing to be characterized purely by a corporatist mentality and corporatist priorities. There's a lot of them there. Most human beings these days see themselves as consumers anyway. So the activities they're going to want to get involved in online are going to be, you know, consumer-type activities. Let's chat about the new iPod or iPhone or where do I buy this and how do I buy that? What's your favorite brand? Who are your favorite, you know, movie actors? Those are the social currencies that most people and kids today understand. But it's still, best of all, I think, served as a model for a different kind of human interaction. Now, I don't think the internet in itself saves the world, but it's a way of saying, I'm here, are you there, and someone else is there. It's a way of going through something together rather than apart. It's kind of remedial help for a society that's lost the ability to connect. But the connections, while meaningful, they're not as real as the ones you can get by actually encountering another person in physical space. You know, that there's so little of our reality scaled to our body, to the human form, to the interactions of real people. And even to suggest it is to bring up accusations of protectionism and, oh, regionalism and provincialism and all that. But it's like, you know, no, in the end, we are incarnate. You know, that in the period of time when you're alive, you're in this body, and having a few things in your life that are scaled to your body and to real interactions with other humans that you look at and do stuff with, I believe is extremely important, both for us as kind of in terms of meaning and values and spirit, if you will, but also in terms of our ability to have the planet sustain to sustain our organism. We're going to need to relate to the planet a bit more directly.
Well, Doug Rushkoff, your book is Life Incorporated. It is a terrific read. It is just packed with ideas and information, how the world became a corporation, and how to take it back. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be actually talking with you.
Thank you, Doug.
Doug Rushkoff has written extensively on the media, technology, and culture. He had the first column on cyberculture for the New York Times and has also written for The Guardian, the online magazine Daily Beast, and others. He's also a graphic novelist and teaches media studies at the New School University in New York. Next up, Jeff Charlotte and Trouble Brewing on the Christian Right. When sex scandals involving three prominent Republican politicians hit the media this summer, few initially made the connection with a secretive fundamentalist group that calls itself the Family. But in a surprise move, the fundamentalist Christian journal World recently published a scathing investigative critique of the Family and its relationship with the three politicians, Senator Ensign of Nevada, Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, and former Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi. All three reside or have resided at a house on C Street in Washington, D.C., owned and operated by the Family. We talked with my next guest, Jeff Charlotte, in 2008 about his book called The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. He gave us a terrific interview. So when he emailed me recently about World's article and what it meant in the landscape of America's Christian right, I leapt at the chance to bring him back on the show. I started out by asking Jeff Charlotte to tell us about the C Street House.
Well, the C Street House is a Capitol Hill ministry run by the group that I write about in my book called The Family. The Family is the oldest, most influential religious right organization in the United States. And unlike most Christian right groups, they're not interested in the souls of the masses. They believe that Jesus' message was actually not meant for most people. It was only meant for a small select, an elect, in the sort of the Calvinist sense. And those are typically powerful men, congressmen, military leaders, business leaders. The C Street House is a place, it's a former convent that registers a church, and they provide below-market housing for congressmen to live in. This summer, we saw three scandals linked to it. The first was that of Senator Ensign from Nevada, presidential prospect who, it turns out, was living in the C Street House even as he was conducting an affair, and that his brothers at the C Street House, as they're called, helped him cover up the affair, and according to allegations from his mistress's family, actually arranged for the payments to keep her silent. And then there was Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, but who was traipsing off to Argentina to meet his mistress, an affair that the C Street House also helped cover up. And finally, there was former Congressman Chip Pickering of Mississippi. All three are Republicans. All three are real so-called family values guys. Chip Pickering, though, is perhaps the least family-oriented of the three. He, according to allegations from his wife and divorce proceedings, was actually carrying on his affair in the C Street House with his mistress, who was the heiress to a major corporation for which he then became a lobbyist. So these three sex scandals turned attention toward first the C Street House, but then the family and the much larger story of the group behind the C Street House.
You mentioned that these guys were all family values conservatives. In fact, they inveighed against Clinton, President Clinton, about his affairs in public. So there's a bit of a hypocrisy here, shall we say?
Well, yes, I think surely there is hypocrisy, but not from their perspective. In fact, Governor Sanford laid it out pretty plainly when explaining why he was not going to resign from office, even though he had called on Clinton to do so for the exact same acts. He said, "Well, I'm like King David." So first of all, we see that modesty is not such a virtue in the family. But more importantly, what this tips us off to is sort of the theological justification that the family uses for these guys. And when I heard that, I was... I immediately recognize it as family teaching. It's a core teaching, the idea of King David being a model for power because King David is chosen for leadership. And the family would explain that King David's actually not a good guy in all throughout the story in the Bible. You know, he's a man who seduces another man's wife and then arranges to have that man killed to clear the path for him. And the family would point to this and they say, why do we still revere this guy? Is it because he's good? No, it's because he's chosen. He's chosen for leadership. And David Coe, one of the men who's been in the news, the leader of the family, has been a spiritual advisor to Senator Ensign, explained this to me once. He said, this is what it means to be chosen. He says, well, suppose I hear you rape three little girls. He was addressing himself to a younger man in the family. The man said, you'd think I was awful, of course. And David Coe said, no, I wouldn't. The reason being that as a member of the family, you're chosen. It doesn't mean that you should go doing these horrible things, but whether you do or don't has nothing to do with God's selection for you as a person of power.
So this is really a theology of impunity, basically.
Yeah. Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina, another Republican who lives in the C Street House, came to the defense of his philandering brothers in Christ by saying that the C Street House is really about accountability. You have to ask yourself what kind of accountability takes place behind closed doors because, of course, the C Street House, the first rule of C Street is that you don't talk about C Street. It's a very secretive place. But moreover, you look at what they mean by accountability. Accountability means that Governor Sanford, Senator Ensign, Representative Pickering, they did talk with their fellow politicians about what they'd been doing. They were accountable to the fellow members of the family, but not to the public, not to the public trust that they betrayed, not to their own families. And in fact, their fellow members of the family helped them cover up their affairs. So that's what they mean by accountability.
Now, one of the interesting things about this article in the World is that this is an evangelical Christian publication. I thought it was a pretty well-written article, some pretty good journalism there. It detailed also the financial dealings of this of the family, and they have 20 million. I'm not sure that's the right figure, but they have a lot of money. But the critique of the article was precisely this, that these people were not acting like true Christians, that they weren't accountable, that what they call a church is not even a church. So talk about the significance of this. Is there a developing schism now in the evangelical Christian community around this group?
Yeah, there really is. The same day this article came out in The World, which is really the leading Christian right magazine in the United States, Pat Robertson's 700 Club did a segment defending C Street, ending with his TV anchor saying, "I applaud Doug Coe for what he does, and I applaud him for keeping it secret." Fortunately, the reporters over at The World, and they did a terrific job of investigative journalism. They're a little late to the party. When I first released this book in hardcover last year, I went and sat with them for a very long, amiable interview, which they then wrapped up with an article accusing me of conspiracy theory for making a big deal about the family, which they thought was a modest, humble Christian fellowship. Now here they are with a big cover story confirming everything I said and then adding some. You know, you mentioned that the sum of $19 million. That's one of the many interlinked foundations related to the family. The World pointed out the two of them, one called the International Foundation, another called the Fellowship Foundation, are both under the umbrella of the family. If this is so, this is going to lead to a lot of questions for congressmen who have been traveling on the tab of one or the other of these foundations, even as they're listing the sponsor of their travel as other organizations. That's possibly illegal, certainly unethical. So what's happening is one part of the Christian right is turning on the other, and doing so mainly for good reasons, I think. You know, I think they tended to sort of feel that any sort of questioning of Christian right politicians was motivated by liberal leftist concerns. But I think when they started looking more closely at the family, they encountered a group that presented them with a whole other set of concerns. For instance, as they report, within the family, the word Christian is taboo. They don't like the word Christian. So for fundamentalists, this is going to be unsettling. Was uneasy. The lack of accountability made them uneasy. Their relationships with foreign dictators like Suharto and Ferdinand Marcos and Siad Barre of Somalia, all that they recognize as problematic, and especially the secrecy. I was glad World Magazine really attacked this culture of secrecy, even as Pat Robertson, CBN, was telling his millions of viewers, these people are more powerful than us, and we shouldn't bother them with questions.
Jeff Charlotte, what is the significance of this schism for the rest of us, most of whom were not members of the Christian right, given the power of this group, the family, and the criticism now mounted to it by the more ideologically pure segment of the Christian right? What is the significance of this schism? Because here you have the most powerful group of the Christian right being turned on by, let's say, the more theologically pure sector of the right.
Yeah. Well, I think the significance for the rest of us is that we've long had, for 70 years, this group has been very influential. David Kuo, former Bush special assistant in the White House, called them the most powerful group in Washington nobody knows. They're explicitly anti-democratic. They do their best to ally the United States with the worst elements and a lot of dictatorial regimes around the world. This is not the stuff of democracy, and yet a lot of the establishment press won't take it on, partly because papers like the Washington Post and New York Times, when they think of fundamentalists, they tend to think of a guy like the late Jerry Falwell or something like that, you know, a Southern guy pounding his pulpit and thumping his Bible, and they only recognize that kind of fundamentalism when it marches into the public square shouting its intentions, and they're very contemptuous of that, even though, to give that its due, that's democratic. When you go pound in your pulpit in the public square, you're making your case. We can disagree with your case, but you are actually participating in democracy. And what we're seeing right now is the Christian right, via World Magazine, doing the work that, frankly, the establishment press has been too lazy or too comfortable with power to do, which is holding politicians accountable, saying you say one thing, but you do another. You accept money from this group, but you keep it quiet. You say you stand for democracy, and yet you belong to this group that's opposed to democracy. You need to explain yourselves to us. So we really have the populist front within the Christian right doing the work that, frankly, the New York Times should be doing.
Are there some new developments?
Yeah, well, since, I mean, the scandal really sort of broke a lot of things open. I ended up teaming up with a foundation called the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, especially their research director, Chris Rada, and working together, we decided to follow up on some of the scandals. First of all, we went through Senator Ensign's travel records, and we discovered he'd been traveling around the world on the family's dime. Senator Tom Coburn, Republican of Oklahoma, had been doing the same thing. In fact, we found documents where Coburn describes going to the religiously torn country of Lebanon and trying to set up Christian prayer cells in the Lebanese government, just like the one through which he helped cover up Senator Ensign's affair. Senator Inhofe of Oklahoma, James Inhofe of Oklahoma, another Republican, came to the family's defense saying, it's just personal religion, you know, protected by freedom of religion, and I use the C Street House to conduct foreign policy meetings. We found Senator Inhofe boasting of having taken 20 missionary trips throughout Africa, promoting what he called the political philosophy of Jesus, as taught to him by Doug Coe, boasting about using his status as a U.S. senator to open the doors into the, you know, the highest offices in these African countries. And was he doing this all on the family's dime, which would be a lobbying problem? No, he's doing it on our dime. He was charging all this to the Senate Armed Services Committee. So we're starting to just unravel this whole morass of overlapping spending. We started looking at another member of the C Street House, a guy named Representative Zach Womp, and we discovered that through his through a subcommittee on appropriations, he and three other family men have been channeling tens of millions of dollars to the construction of megachurch chapels on military bases around the United States.
And this is public funds?
This is public money, and a lot of public money. Some of the biggest military construction in the upcoming 2010 appropriations bill is going to be a megachurch chapel at Fort Campbell in Kentucky, Fort Hood in Texas. These are bases, by the way, that had extensive chapel facilities already. They weren't wanting for chapels. What they didn't have was a megachurch chapel. Meanwhile, these same politicians teamed up to block a request for a very needed, very ecumenical chapel at the Dover Air Force Base, where the dead from Iraq and Afghanistan are brought home, and they needed a chapel for the grieving families, and they couldn't find it in their hearts to fund that. All these kinds of sordid stories of religion and federal dollars are just tumbling out. The Military Religious Freedom Foundation has been really good on this, but what it's doing is actually provoking a lot of really good local journalism. So now we're seeing investigations in Wichita, Kansas City, Asheville, North Carolina, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Nashville, Tennessee, Jackson, Mississippi, all these local papers doing the work that the establishment press really has kind of shied away from.
And this dovetails with your most recent article in Harper's Magazine, and I don't have it in front of me. As I remember, it was called Jesus Kills Muhammad. Is that right?
It was named after an inscription that some special forces in Iraq painted in giant Arabic letters on the side of a Bradley fighting vehicle, a fast-moving tank, essentially, which they then drove through the streets of Samarra, and basically when people took issue with that, they just turned the big guns on them and blasted them away. I interviewed the then lieutenant who drove that vehicle. He's since been promoted to a captain for this kind of bravery, and he said that he was protected on his mission by God, that because his chaplain had arranged for a special viewing of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ that morning. It was Easter Sunday in Samarra. I mean, a very, very disturbing story, and it really does connect. One of the things, in that article, Jesus Killed Muhammad, I wrote about a military group called Officers Christian Fellowship. 15,000 officers are part of this. Very fundamentalist, opposed not just to non-Christians, but even Christians they consider insufficiently dedicated to the cause. They call them spiritual terrorists. They speak of reclaiming territory for Christ in the military, and they say that anybody who opposes them in this mission is part of an opposition spearheaded by Satan. These are some fundamentalist folks. They're not fringe. We're talking about some of the highest-ranking generals in the military. One of the things we've discovered since these scandals is by sort of working backwards through, and teaming up with some other researchers, OCF is actually owes its existence in large part to the family. In the 40s and 50s, the family was instrumental in the creation of Officers Christian Fellowship. And we start to see a united front that goes right up to the present through another Christian right group called Christian Embassy, which focuses on the Pentagon. And we, just in the past month, have discovered that the family is paying for congressmen to travel as representatives of the United States, but also as representatives of Christian Embassy. So suddenly, we have this kind of elite congressional fundamentalism, we have this military fundamentalism, and there seems to be a fairly united front between them.
Is this a conspiracy? What do you think
about it? It's not a conspiracy. Well, it's not a conspiracy. Remember, conspiracy is a legal term, and we've got to use it carefully. It is, what it is a social movement. It's a secretive social movement, but that's not illegal. It looks like some of the way the money is moving right now and paying for congressional travel, that probably is illegal. If it wasn't illegal, for instance, when Senator Coburn traveled to Lebanon several years ago, a family's dime, it probably would be today under the 2007 Open Government Act, which followed the Jack Abramoff scandals. So there's that kind of stuff. But the real issue here is not one of, you know, tinkering around the edges and enforcing ethics laws. The question is one of a massive social movement. And I've always been sort of puzzled by people who would call this a conspiracy theory, because what we're talking about is social history in the United States. A social history with deep roots of people who believe that the United States was created to be a Christian nation, and it's their job to help it get back on that footing. That's a strong sentiment in the United States. The family is the most elite representation of that.
What do you think is the most important thing that people need to do to weaken this movement?
I think the best thing people can do is keep the pressure on. Ask questions of their representatives. Ask questions of their local press. Find out if your representative is involved in this. There's quite a few who are involved, not too many who are involved at the level of, say, Inhofe or Coburn or Ensign. Your representative might attend one of the weekly meetings, not knowing that he's involved in this very anti-democratic group. Let your representative know about it. This really has been a kind of remarkable thing that's happened this summer, because it just gathered so much steam, the story, without the big, you know, New York Times, Washington Post ever really taking it on, but it managed to sort of just steamroll without that. And I think that's because there's a lot of folks who understand that politics in America are more complicated than simply Republicans and Democrats. I like one party or the other. The family has always been about 80% Republican, but there are Democrats involved, mostly conservative Democrats, but even a few liberal Democrats. The question is, you want to look at what the group does, not at the party affiliations of its members. You want to look at what it stands for and how it pursues those goals. And, you know, the twin goals of the family are what they call biblical capitalism, which is a sort of radically deregulated market, and the expansion of American power with the idea of what they used to call worldwide spiritual offensive, the idea that the United States has a special destiny to lead the world to Jesus.
Well, Jeff Charlotte, thanks so much for talking with us again here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Jeff Charlotte writes about religious groups for Harper's and Rolling Stone. You can find links to his article, Jesus Killed Muhammad, as well as to our previous interviews with him on writersvoice.net. We also link to the article by World Magazine. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.